So far, we've been looking at the murderers who contributed aspects to Jame Gump, Buffalo Bill. But what about Hannibal Lecter? That brilliant creation, Hannibal the Cannibal. You may have felt, in thinking about Ed Gein, that Oscar Wilde was right, that art does a much better job than nature. For Jame Gump is entertaining, with his camp manner, skilled craftsmanship, and sentimental attachment to his miniature poodle. Ed Gein was merely sordid. Oscar's dictum holds even truer of Hannibal Lecter. Would that cannibal murderers could in some way add to the gaiety of nations by their penetrating intellect, perfect taste, wit, and stylish good manners. Alas, they're characteristically much stupider than the slightly above average sexual serial killers, as was the ghoul Gein. And America's best-known cannibal was a depressingly sordid character indeed. The name Hamilton Fish rings with a certain distinction in the USA. The Fishes took part in the American Revolutionary War, and that makes them hereditary aristocracy by American standards. The first fish to be christened Hamilton was named by a father who admired Alexander Hamilton, the Federalist statesman of the early post-revolutionary period. A Hamilton Fish was an important member of President Grant's cabinet, and in 1931 there was still an important Senator Hamilton Fish high up in the councils of the Republican Party. Albert Hamilton Fish was not so distinguished. Born in 1870, the son of a poor family, he was placed in an orphanage by his mother when his father died in 1875. Many children have bad memories of early institutional care and punishments. Fish had good memories. He remembered with great pleasure the teacher who used to spank them. While other kids feared and hated it, he loved having his pants pulled down and the hard hand whipping him on his bare bottom. "Nothing is greater than pain," he would say later, "if only it didn't hurt so much." Not that his masochistic pleasure in spanking meant that he was a happy child. Quite the reverse. He was a bedwetter. He was withdrawn and inarticulate. He tended to stammer. He feared other children and their teasing, and he especially hated his name Hamilton, which led to his being nicknamed Ham and Eggs. As soon as he could, he dropped it, and thereafter called himself Albert Howard Fish. When he left school, he became a house painter. He was not especially good at it, not especially bad, just an ordinary jobbing painter who made a living here and there. In 1898, he married. He was to remain married for nearly 20 years, a good and caring father to his six children. But his wife was rapidly disillusioned with him. In 1902, he served his first prison sentence, starting his criminal career with an unusually grand theft by the miserable and petty standards he was to establish for himself. He was working for a finance company as janitor and general handyman when he heard a conversation in the office indicating that the firm would shortly be going broke and ceasing to trade. That would mean his job was gone and everybody lost everything anyway. Why, wondered Fish, shouldn't he secure his own future immediately? He stole $800 from the office and absconded. It didn't take long for the police to catch up with him, and he did a couple of years in Sing Sing. By 1914, Mrs. Fish had had enough of him. She packed her bags and left, moving to another part of the country, and marrying a man called Straub, by whom she had another three children. Albert Fish remained attached to his own children, and they to him. His eldest son, Albert II, occasionally worked for him as a house painter. But by now, Fish's perversions were taking over his life. Most notably, he was a child molester. He would go out to work wearing overalls, shoes and socks, and nothing else. Then, if he could lure a child into a basement, he could be out of his clothes in a flash and back into them again as quickly. He learned fast that children rarely tell. With stupid, detached moralizing, he blamed one 12-year-old girl whom he abused persistently for being very loose and said disapprovingly that he'd never seen anything like it. He was genuinely very fond of little girls in a quite normal and healthy way if they happened to be his natural daughters or granddaughters. He could be quite fond of them in a peculiar and unhealthy way if he'd contracted some sort of unreal relationship with them. For example, he contracted three bigamous marriages, apparently rather spur-of-the-moment short-term liaisons. One of them was to a Mrs. Myra Nicholas of Bartlett, Ohio, who had a daughter, Mary. Fish seemed very fond of the little girl, and years later, when he realized she would have reached the age of 18, he wrote to her, "So my sweet little girlie will be 18 on the 28th. I wish I could be there. You know what you would get from your daddy. I would wait until you were in bed and then give you 18 hard smacks on your bare behind." Apparently turned on by the idea, he then went on to share with Mary another new delight he'd discovered. "There is one of the largest pools in the U.S. in the Westside YMCA. Sometimes there are over 200 men and boys, all of them naked. Any boy or man can go in and see them for 25 cents. Not much use to Mary as a piece of information, though such voyeurism might have been healthier coming from her than from her short-term stepfather. But Albert's real preference was for boys. In particular, he interfered with little black boys. This was not because of a peculiar racial sexual interest, just the calculated and deplorable observation that the police made less effort to follow up complaints about interference with black than with white children. At one time, he even employed a little black girl to introduce black boys to him. His great dream was of castrating a little boy, but it seems that he never managed this. He did, however, abuse children sadistically, and he also startled children he was not actually abusing by beating himself in their presence. Mary Nicholas recalled that during the single week that his marriage to her mother lasted, he used to come in the evenings wearing only a pair of underpants and play a game called Buck, Buck, Hands Up with the children. They had to hold up hands with a given number of fingers showing. He guessed how many they were showing, and every time he got it wrong, they beat him with a stick. He had a paddle with nails driven through it to punish himself also. His bizarre activities were not exclusively sexual. Once his son saw him standing on a knoll where some boys were playing football nearby and screaming over and over again, "I am Christ! I am Christ!" Once his daughter found him sleeping rolled up in a carpet in the hall. Once he sprinkled lime and set a trap in the basement to catch a non-existent black cat. Often, before coming out of the lavatory, he would build a little pile of toilet paper on the floor and set fire to it. Once, when he left lodgings because the landlady had refused to whip him, he left little piles of excrement behind him in the bedroom. It was probably in 1926 that he ate his first person. He took a boy called Gaffney to a house on Riker Avenue, New York, that he knew because he'd once painted it. There he tied him up and gagged him after stripping him naked. He left the lad alone overnight, returning the next day with tools for cutting him up and a homemade cat-o'-nine-tails. He whipped the boy till he bled, cut off his nose, lips and ears, and probably killed him by pushing a knife through his eye. Then he stuck his knife in the boy's belly and drank the blood that flowed out. One of the most extraordinary and gruesome documents I have ever read is Fish's subsequent account of how he cooked and ate him, a real cannibal's cookbook that does not suggest a delicious feast. The feast that made Fish infamous occurred in the summer of 1929. 18-year-old Edward Budd wanted to get out of the hot and sticky city and put an ad in the New York World saying he wanted summer employment in the country. Mr. Fish answered it, representing himself as a Mr. Howard and saying he had a farm in Westchester County and he would like Edward to work for him. He visited the Budd family to make preliminary arrangements, apologizing for the fact that he had to go down to Jersey about the sale of a cow and would not be able to take Edward on for a week. During the week, he bought himself a butcher's cleaver and a knife and a steel. On his way out to the Budds the following week, he left his tools at a newsstand, and he bought some cottage cheese in a plain pot and some strawberries at a delicatessen. These were solemnly presented to Mrs. Budd as the produce of his farm. Now, it was occurring to Mr. Fish that Edward would be a bit big and difficult to dispose of. Moreover, he'd not really find him attractive. 12-year-old Grace Budd, who sat on his knee at table, was another matter. Improvising quickly, he told the Buds his sister had just such a child and she was having a party that afternoon. Perhaps Grace would like to go to it for a couple of hours. Then he'd bring her back and collect Edward for the journey to the country. The Buds were quite agreeable. Mr. Howard gave them a non-existent address in Columbus Avenue as his sister's house, and in his respectable, if rather shabby, three-piece suit, walked the child away. He picked up his butcher's implements, my tools of hell, as he later called them, from the newsstand. And he did not take Grace to Columbus Avenue. He took her a long train journey with a couple of changes, out through the suburbs, past White Plains, to an empty house in Westchester County. There he told the girl to pick flowers outside while he looked for his sister. In fact, he went upstairs and undressed. It was to avoid getting blood on his clothes, he told police at first, later correcting this to the fact that he liked being naked and wanted to expose himself to the little girl. When she came upstairs and saw him, she screamed that she would tell her mother. Mr. Fish promptly strangled her, complaining querulously 4 years later that she'd scratched and kicked him. Then he butchered the body quickly and neatly. And then, with the table in front of him covered with human meat, he took a large swab of cotton wool from his pocket, soaked it in lighter fuel, and stuffed it into his anus. That done, he ignited it, and danced round the room, enjoying his own leaps and howls of pain, as his rectum singed, until at last he enjoyed a sexual climax. He seems to have been quite proud that he resisted ravishing his little victim. He wrote anonymously to her mother 4 years later, I did not f*** her, though I could have had I wished. She died a virgin. But not to rest in peace. He took her arm back that day, chopping it into three pieces and stewing it with onions, carrots, potatoes, and parsley in a pint of water with a bouillon cube, salt, and pepper. Over the next 9 days, he returned to the house regularly to fetch back other joints until he had eaten Grace all up. Occasionally he varied his recipe by using strips of bacon. And he still enjoyed one cut more than any other. How sweet and tender her little ass was roasted in the oven, he exulted. The police were baffled. The Budd family only knew Mr. Fish as Frank Howard, and no one had any idea where Grace had gone. Nor was it obvious why anyone should have abducted her, if not for sexual purposes. Although Fish was frequently pulled in by New York Police Department for petty thefts, for suspected child molesting, and for posting obscene anonymous letters, nobody connected him with the Grace Budd disappearance until, 4 years later, he sent that anonymous letter to Mrs. Budd. Since it gave an accurate description of the meal at the Budd's from which he had abducted Grace, the police knew this really was from their man. They now set about with some efficient detective work to trace him. The envelope in which the letter was posted bore the initials of a New York gentleman's club. It seemed unlikely that any of their members would be the semi-literate, perverse, cannibal letter writer. But inquiries revealed that a porter at the club had filched some stationery and left it in the room where he'd ceased boarding a month previously. To the rooming house hurried the police, only to find that the porter's successor, a Mr. Albert Fish, had also left. But the landlady assured them he would be coming back around the first of the month to collect money sent by his son. When he did so, detectives were waiting for him. When they told him they wanted to ask some questions about Grace, the shabby old man blearily nodded his agreement and thoughtfully took a razor blade out of his coat pocket. The police hastily confiscated it. There was one more surprise awaiting them when Mr. Fish had been charged and fingerprinted. An X-ray revealed 29 needles pushed into his body, 27 of them in the general area of the perineum, scrotum, and rectum. One was a monstrous curved sailmaker's needle. Several had been inside him so long they had almost corroded away. Fish had inserted them himself. He offered various reasons. To enjoy the pain, certainly the most likely in his case. To purge himself of sin. He had developed a most peculiar religiomania, and he believed at times that he was required, like the patriarch Abraham, to sacrifice boys, like Isaac, to the Lord. Or in the hope that the needles would make him bleed to death internally. Mr. Fish was obviously revoltingly mad. The distinguished psychiatrist Frederick Wortham said he was the most polymathic, perverse personality he had ever encountered, and claimed that he seemed to have practiced every single perversion Dr. Wortham had ever heard of. Actually, by my check, I can't find that Fish ever practiced bestiality. But it was deliberate omission on my part to spare your finer feelings that I made no mention of the part excrement and urine played in his diet. Despite this, his plea of insanity failed to convince the jury, who probably wanted this disgusting piece of moral detritus swept into the garbage bin as fast as possible. Albert Fish was sentenced to death by electrocution, a prospect which filled him with glee, as it should prove a greater than ever experience of mighty pain. It took two shots to kill him, and one newspaper speculated that his collection of perineal needles had shorted the system. This is often claimed, but in fact they had been removed while he was in prison, and Albert had been reduced to trying to replace them with a sharpened chicken bone. Now, that's what a real cannibal is like. Not the suave and sinister likeness of Dr. Hannibal Lecter, is it? Bottom of the heap depravity and utterly squalid mental demoralization seems to be the norm for Western cannibals. Not that I object at all to Thomas Harris's creation. It would be a far better world if cannibals were like Dr. Lecter. But don't go away with the impression that I would approve of cannibalism if only it were carried out tastefully. I will happily aver with Michael Flanders and Donald Swan that eating people is wrong.